Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Capital Spotlight Podcast. Your host, Craig McGrother, alongside Rob Beardsley, the principal and founder of Lone Star Capital, coming off of what was an incredibly busy week at RaiseFest. Oh my gosh, the setup for everything, crazy. But before we get into that, we want to do a little bit of housekeeping. So first off, our team will be in Houston for a meetup at one of our properties. I believe Meritage, is that correct?
Yep.
Yeah, so we're going to be there. We'll let you know the dates of when that will be, but it's going to be a bit the second week of March, correct?
Yeah, it's going to be March 12th. So if you're a LP, a potential partner of ours, please reach out so that we can get you RSVP'd, assuming you're a good fit, and we'd love to see you there.
And I just want to kind of go through a little bit more, because typically speaking, when we're on the road and meeting people, it's often just you and myself, right? But this time there's gonna be a lot more members of the team that will be there. So it'll be you and me, of course, our Radiance Living property management team, because of course we are a vertically integrated sponsor with property management in-house located in Houston, which is perfect. So you'll be able to meet Aaron and a couple of other, I think, representatives of the Radiance side of the business. Will Kent be there?
No.
Okay, Jason?
Yes.
Josh?
Yes.
Dasha?
Yes.
Dan?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, but more than half the team will be there along as well with the ancillary side of the business. So that's great. Once more, reach out to me if you're looking to learn more about that. My email, of course, you know it, but once more, it's Craig, C-R-A-I-G, at lscre.com. That's housekeeping item number one. The second item I want to speak on or hit on, actually, is I think I have AirPods in. That's a little bit funny. Second item we want to touch on is our New York City mixer, which I believe is on April 4th. So once more, if you are a good fit as well, Kent will, in fact, be there. Of course, the member of the team who is arguably just with you the most important, but is seen the least, if you'd like to meet with him and pick his brain a bit, he will in fact be there alongside not the Radiance team but the whole corporate side of the business. So we will all be there. That is on April 4th, of course, at our office. That is very exciting. And then, of course, what we'd like to do is set meetings for all the conferences that we go to. We will, in fact, be at the Best Ever Conference in Salt Lake City on April 11th and 12th. We just had a great success at RaiseFest, which we'll just get into in a second, but we're going to be hosting dinners again, meeting with any potential co-GP, capital raiser, joint venture equity partner, LP investor. If you fit those buckets and are looking to learn more about the Lone Star Capital process, please reach out to me there and be sure to square you away. On to the first topic of the show, which is RaiseFest recap. So what a conference. Rob spoke at it. He was on the panel. He also had a keynote. That was a lot of fun.
The keynote was super exhilarating. It was a massive audience, massive stage with huge screens. So it definitely made you look like, or made me, humbly, look like a celebrity. And it was a really cool experience. So I actually kind of dread speaking sometimes. And you've got that anticipation where you're nervous. But then once you get on stage, you settle in. And then afterwards, you've got that buzz, right?
Right. And I'm sure that buzz wore on for a while. And, you know, one thing I'll really give credit to for the event is often there's the room and then there's the meetings outside of the rooms. And the great thing about this event was for you, of course, was basically, I don't know how many people were there, but let's just kind of guesstimate around somewhere between 600 to 1,000 people probably attended. Maybe not all at once was there that many people, but the room was essentially fully packed the entire time for all the speakers. So everyone who was there basically got to hear you speak and speak while you did. You even hit them with the Shador Sanders, which was super special, but I really liked that. And then not only did you do the keynote, but you were also were on the coach's call for Raise Masters, which you are a coach, of course, or have been for the last couple of years. So you were there alongside some very, very heavy hitters, to name a few, Reed Goossens, Brian Spear,
Tyler Lyons, Catherine Bell.
Exactly. So some really cool and special, unique people there. And then, of course, we got to meet with so many awesome people who are current partners, prospective partners. And then my favorite part of the whole event, of course, was the dinners that we hosted. So we brought some of our favorite people on Wednesday and Thursday night. Not, I guess, favorite people, but business partners, people who have been partnering deals recently to make sure that we're taking care of them, as we'd like to wine and dine all of our favorite people, of course, that so graciously bring us their capital and, you know, work so hard alongside us for a deal. So we got to go to Buck and Ryder, which is probably the most Eaton restaurant that we go to.
It's very Lone. It's like Lone Star's official restaurant of Phoenix.
You know what it is? It's like what Reserve Cut is to New York is right. What Buck and Rider is to Phoenix. So we went there, of course, had a great dinner there, and then we went very greedy to a double seafood dinner night kind of night at Mastro City Hall in Scottsdale, and that was special. I think everyone really felt appreciated, and you know, we just can't thank everyone enough for partnering with us. And you know, I'll just say this about Race Fest: the energy was really great. I just felt like it was such a awesome space where people just felt very excited and gracious and just had amazing energy all throughout. So Hunter, thank you so much for putting that together and creating such an amazing group and space and environment for us to, you know, work with, to raise money with, to meet meaningful and deep relationships with that go outside of just, you know, the business side of it. You know, everyone we met with there at the event for both dinners and stuff, I think half were in, half were out, but it was just a really fun event.
I think what you said about people's energy being high is really important considering the circumstances, right? Commercial real estate isn't exactly booming right now. And the fact that people are there excited about doing new deals, excited about moving forward.
Excited to meet you.
Excited to meet us, build relationships, grow, is a really great sign, and also just a sign of that we're hanging around high quality people. Those dinners that we're hosting are the reason why they're so valuable is not because Lone Star is whining and dining their clients and we're trying to, you know, pay our thanks, right? It's an opportunity for our partners to meet our other partners and to see, oh, wow, this is a high quality group. This is a group that's worth, it's social proof, right? And that speaks volumes, and it also speaks to the confidence that we have that we can actually, not that this is a huge deal, but before we kind of felt like, hey, we need to keep our dinners small so we can make sure that we have a chance to interact with everybody and give everyone FaceTime. But in reality, we can actually host slightly larger dinners and people can still get a lot out of it because they might perhaps interact with you and I a little bit less and not hear from Lone Star as much, but they're hearing from partners of ours and
extensions of ourselves.
Yeah, and people can cross-pollinate. They can talk about Lone Star or the deals that they're working on that aren't with Lone Star and things like that.
Absolutely, and I feel very confident after being at the event that, you know, we can raise a lot and there's a lot of money that's sitting ready to go and people are looking to place. So that was really awesome. And, you know, I think the other benefit to doing dinners is when you're in kind of a environment where it's more business formal and whatnot, some of the secrets aren't coming out as much, but when you get people in the dinner, you get a couple drinks and then maybe, or, you know, I don't think our table really drank that much alcohol, although the bill would
say otherwise. Our investors are quite the cheap dinner, right?
Exactly.
Almost nobody was drinking.
I was slightly offended. It's like, you guys are just making our lives too easy, although we had to really run up the credit card bill, of course, with the double seafood.
We made up for it with the lobster.
Exactly. The lobster, the crab, the king crab, the whole nine, the oysters, the steaks, so on and so forth. But it's funny. A lot more information was slowly trickling out and being divulged, and that's due to two things. Maybe a little bit of liquid courage, but now you're outside of a more formal work setting where people can kind of let their guard down. But the really special thing is everyone that we met with at dinner, of course, business is always going to be talked about, right? But it was the other side of it, which was, okay, wow, people are really allowing us to see who they are as people. And it just makes me love to work that way that much more and makes me appreciate and makes me that much more passionate about what I get to do, because who we work with is so cool. Who we work with are so special. These are people that I would, you know, genuinely want to be friends with and check in with. So I just feel so special that we're in a position where we're attracting people like that, that these are super successful, you know, high net worth, accredited investors, millionaires that are sitting with us, giving us their time, that, you know, want to spend time with us and are appreciating what we're doing. And, you know, it just makes me want to be that much more professional and that much more on it and just triple down, not even double down, but triple down on what we're doing currently, because it is working. And I think there's just no substitute, as you know, for meeting in person. And I think I'm making it a goal within the next couple years to meet at least at some point every single investor that we have, every capital raiser and every investor we have. If, you know, if one is a fund manager and their investor comes in, that's not our investor, we'd want to meet with the fund manager. But our LPs, as well as our capital raising partners, we need to know where they are, where they live, what they're doing. So if you're that person, please email me and we'll make a point to meet with you.
To finish off this topic, on the panel that I was on with Brian Spear, Brian was just...
Oh my gosh.
I was not privy to his bar-dropping abilities and super impressed. I mean, obviously, we always knew he was a legit guy, but what I'll finish with is his point about the 7-11-4 rule. And this is exactly what we're talking about. So the 7 is what, the amount of times that you need to meet someone?
7 times you need to meet with someone, 11 different places, and 4 hours with that person.
11 different places, that's a lot.
7 hours.
It's something like that. Basically, different places, you need time, places, and multiple interactions.
Yeah, well, good thing is that if it's a four-hour affair, 2 hours at dinner last night knocked that out a lot, which is great. So, and, you know, the quality of partner that we had there was just really special. So we're just, as I said, so, so grateful. To those who are at dinner, you know who you are. We just feel very, I felt very touched and very whole going to bed after those nights with a belly full of food and then a heart full of love and a brain full of like amazing thoughts, thinking about what we want to do next, what we want to implement. And the beautiful thing is that the people we were there with, well, I know this thought, of course, but, or maybe if you have one more, the beautiful thing about the people we're there with is they find best in class people. So not only do they view us as best in class, which is the biggest compliment they can pay, but guess what? Other people have really great systems too. We are always looking to get better, so they get to share with us incredible ideas and thoughts that will just only incrementally improve us, because it's hard to just go from here and really double up our abilities, you know, overnight, because our infrastructure is so great. But getting incrementally better is really how we're going to, you know, level up and keep, you know, applying the pressure and getting the compounding effect of our growth. So doing what people are recommending and doing what other people deem to be first in class on top of what we're doing currently, and to triple down on the in-person events is just really going to set us up.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I know we're starting to get long in the tooth here, but your point about our partners obviously have the luxury of partnering with other sponsors, whoever they want, right? And naturally, if these are high quality fund managers, they're going to, and they're partnering with us, they're going to seek out other high quality sponsors to partner with. And so they're going to see who does what the best. So maybe there's things that Lone Star does the best, but maybe there's other sponsors that that do better than Lone Star in a different category, and they can let us know. So I think that's a really important point. And obviously, we're humble enough to actually, we deliberately and specifically ask, hey, what are your other sponsors doing amazing that we can piggyback on and also copy? So I know that at dinner at Mastro's, one of our partners just kind of nudged me and said, by the way, XYZ partner of mine does this. That'd be super cool if you could do that too.
And it also just accretive for us as well, because it was regarding a social media post where if we just give them prepackaged social media, well, then they're just singing our praises and it goes through, and that's awesome. So couldn't agree with
them
more.
There's no reason to get competitive. There's no reason to get offended, right? It's all good.
Yeah. So speaking of a topic that one of our meetings brought, this segues perfectly into our first real estate topic today. What is the biggest challenge that we're seeing today in the current market?
Yeah. So this question was asked a lot throughout the meetings we were having.
And we asked them, and they asked us, right? So
yeah. And the answer that I gave is volatility. And volatility, unfortunately, is out of our control for the most part. And when I speak on volatility, I'm specifically talking about treasury volatility, because our strategy these days is focused on fixed rate debt. And as we covered a handful of episodes ago, I believe it was the one that we recorded in my living room, if you remember that one. Also, we're totally bearing the lead here. If you're watching this on YouTube and you're watching the video, we're here in beautiful Sedona.
And he's not wearing a suit.
And I'm not wearing a suit. And you can see we've got the beautiful background. I mean, obviously, this is no New York City skyline view, right? So I'm going to be home soon to that. But
This will do
for now. So if you're watching this on YouTube, we hope you're enjoying this as much as we are. So
Back to the show. Volatility.
Yeah. Volatility is really a big risk when you're talking about fixed rate debt, because when you put a deal under contract, you have to make an assumption on what rate you're going to fix at. And there's a gap in time between putting the deal under contract, you sign the loan application, fund the money, the lender does the due diligence, you order third parties. So it's usually a 60-day process to when you're actually ready to lock the interest rate. And what you're locking is not actually the interest rate, but you're actually index rate locking. And so I know we've covered this before, but just to recap, a fixed rate loan, its interest rate is comprised of two things. You have the loan, the interest rate's index rate, and the spread rate. So there's the index rate, which for our 5-year fixed rate loans is the 5-year US Treasury yield. And then there's a lender spread. And lender spreads these days are anywhere from around 180 to maybe 210 basis points before any buy downs or any funny business. So if you just do simple math, if the Treasury yield is 4% and the lender spread is 2%, you're talking about an all-in rate of 6%. And when you actually lock the rate, what you're, like I said, what you're technically locking is not the total rate, you're locking the index. So you'd be locking the treasury yield at 4%, which today, that would be pretty nice. And then you don't technically lock the spread. So the lender can change the spread on you. And then eventually, kind of right before closing, you actually do a spread lock. But spreads are not nearly as volatile as treasury yields, right? As we all know, treasury yields are determined by the bond market. So bond traders are constantly buying and selling bonds, which pushes the yield up and down respectively. We've been battling volatility in the treasury market tremendously because historically speaking, treasury moves are maybe a couple bips up, couple bips down. A big day is 10 basis points. Well, over the last year and a half, and we've been
The new normal is like 10 basis points. It could be 20 basis points. We've seen
20 basis points in a day.
Yes. Exactly. And unfortunately, it hasn't really been moving in the most positive direction on our end. We really caught that, of course, on the worst of it, just to rehash this, which is 1001 Ross in Dallas, which during the escrow process, we underwrote the deal at a certain number, and then I don't remember the exact debt note, and then during that process, slowly, it went up 75 basis points, making the deal just really not pencil, unfortunately, for our fixed rate needs and our deal structure and profile, which is really unfortunate. And the byproduct of that was walking away from just shy of about $1 million, which really stunk, but none of that matters because what is important is you guys. It's the investor. It's our capital partners who, you know, trust that we're making the best decisions, and they're basically relying on us knowing best. And us knowing best was, of course, walking away from that deal. On the contrary, we actually, in fact, beat the projected debt on Aspire Apartments in San Antonio. Shout out to all of our partners there on that one. But we underwrote on that deal 6%. I believe it was, you know, whatever. I think it was a 185, 184 lender spread.
About a 185 spread, yeah.
And the great news is that, fortunately, the volatility works one way or another. We'd probably rather just be, you know, stagnant so we can kind of forecast it better. But fortunately, we underwrote 6% debt, and it went down to 5.72%, which was awesome, naturally. So that was really in the money, and that will only help probably the cash flow of the deal and other items on that. So, of course, the takeover process, like always, is the biggest risk associated with the deal. Maybe it makes up for some of that there, but all in all, that was really special. We're currently working on a deal right now. I don't know if we can talk too much about it due to the nature of it, but the cliff note of it is that initially when we set the deal out, we also locked in 6%, and then prior to sending out the materials for it, it got to 6.1% on what we're currently looking at right now, which is only going to compress the numbers. It could, you know, I guess run back down, which would be more accretive, or it could run back up. I think we're kind of baking in a substantially higher number, as we like to, of course, under-promise and over-deliver. So that is just kind of the challenges that we're looking at right now, especially as, you know, fixed rate buyers.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot to unpack here. And also I want to go back to 1001 Ross and just make the point that investors didn't lose $1 million. So we didn't lose any investor
Correct.
Capital. We put up company funds to take the risk of executing on the transaction. Unfortunately, the deal didn't go our way. So we terminated the deal, sent investors their money back. So we, like you said, are always putting investors first, and we have to do what's best for the long term of our investors.
And to make a PSA on that note as well, which you so well covered right there, investors assume and accrue approximately zero risk up to close of escrow. So meaning if we, for whatever reason, pull out for the deal because we don't think it's best for you guys, of course, we will eat that cost. We will be the ones who will lose the earnest money deposit, not you guys. You guys get the final product, of course, which is super crucial to think about. You know, we get a lot of the upside, but we don't want to share that part of the downside associated with real estate. Unfortunately, real estate's the best business in the world. That's why we're here. But you can lose money in real estate. There are costs of doing business, and that is sometimes the cost of the world that we're in, and that is the sword we'll live and die by.
So I was going to make a joke about acquisition fees, but I don't think really anyone wants to hear us say, well, us losing money on Ross is why we're able to charge acquisition fees. So don't beat us up on our acquisition fee negotiation too bad.
And we really are conscientious on fees. We do not want to fee everyone to death. That is not the purpose. I think one of the biggest messages going back to the Raise Fest part was people ask, you know, us, what do we look for in capital partners? What do we look for in fund managers, right? And I think the biggest thing is that we, although, as you said, Hackney, with regards to saying our underwriting is conservative, we truly do believe that juxtaposed to a lot of the market options, we are more conservative in nature than not, okay? So we maybe get beaten up here and there in fees, but the most important thing is it all starts with the investor at home, because they're the they drive the bus, right? So making sure they're at best of interest is everything to us. So making sure that they're taken care of is everything, and that goes with, you know, eating earnest money deposits, having reasonable fees, and having a fair structure where we get paid for our work, but the investor gets a slice of obviously the upside, of course, on performance.
And of course, this extends to the investors of our fund managers. We don't take the viewpoint that our fund manager is the end LP and we don't care about what their underlying investors get, right? We actually do care that everyone across the board is being treated right, because our reputation is on the line no matter what, if someone's investing directly or indirectly into one of our opportunities.
And we never want to circumvent any people. So just another PSA, if you're a fund manager working with us, you want to raise capital with us, of course, email me if you haven't re-emailed me yet. But of course, if you are a fund manager, what we're looking to shoot and solve for is to give your investors the exact same deal profile and returns as our investors. Meaning, if we're projecting a deal that's a 16 IRR, your investors will get the same. It will come out a little bit different probably with the cash flow and then the lift at the end, because there are fees associated with the drag of the fund-to-fund process. But just know that we're solving for giving your investors the same experience ours would be on a financial perspective, to not circumvent you out of the process, because we can't do these deals and can't get to scale, and we want to learn from everyone. And the value of partners is we get the brain trust that comes along with them.
Yeah. Well, let me continue on the fixed rate volatility.
Okay.
It is really tough, and unfortunately it is out of our control. Sometimes you're on the winning side of it, like on Aspire, where we were actually able to lock the rate opportunistically on a downtick. So we actually early rate locked. So typically you rate lock really a day or two before closing, because you actually put in the good faith deposit, which is 2% of the loan amount. We talked about this last week, I think. And that's, you don't want to break that. You lose that money if you don't end up closing the deal.
That, along with earnest money, would be hard at that point.
Exactly. So that's a bigger risk as you continue on in the deal. So if you have the confidence that you're for sure going to close and all your due diligence is ready, so for the lender to actually rate lock, then you could do it a little bit earlier. Unfortunately, sometimes they try to negotiate an early rate lock fee on you, which is not, it kind of defeats the purpose of a little bit, right? If you have to pay an 8 basis point spread adder to early rate lock. But fortunately, we have great people on our side. Shout out to Nate Lowy, and
we love you, Nate.
Is able to negotiate that out more times than not, or at least fingers crossed.
Yeah, and with that said as well, over promise and under delivering, we're all about that. I believe we also kind of bake in our modeling a slightly higher rate in there in case we do actually, in fact, rate lock a bit earlier, right? So we do that in order to, you know, that's baked into the process, baked into the fees.
I do want to touch on that, actually. Thank you for bringing that up, because this goes back to conservative underwriting, and you can bake in a big spread. You could say, well, treasuries are volatile right now, therefore I'm going to underwrite a 50 basis point spread into, or cushion into, my all-in rate. So just to paint some quick numbers, if today's treasury rate is 4%, I know it's actually 4.28, but 4% to make it a round number, let's say the lender spread is 2%. So let's say your projected rate, if you were to lock today, is 6%, and you want to be ultra conservative, you could put a 6.5% rate into your model. What's that going to do? Well, it's going to put a lot of cushion into your numbers, so if rates do in fact rise, you'll probably be fine. However, it's going to make your IRR look worse. It's going to make your cash on cash look worse.
So projected IRR, projected
right,
cash on
cash. The projections,
which is the biggest thing. I think one misconception slightly, or one thing that I really want to have people think about, is the numbers that you're looking at are very fluid and are subject to where the market is on the exit, which no one can forecast. So getting so excited or so worked up about the front end IRR, the cash on cash with our fixed rate deals, you can solve for a lot easier, of course, because that's, you know, a little bit more in our
control. There's less manipulation of
correct
cash on cash.
But getting so fixated on, you know, a couple, you know, a full point, not a basis point, but a full point, you know, plus or minus one way or another, you should just love the deal and the business plan and the operator. However the deal stacks up and pencils out on the back end, should be, you know, slightly negligible to a certain extent, because we can't control that. Projections at the end of the day are projections. That's not set in stone. So when we get people beating us up about fees here and there, it's kind of silly, because in our opinion, we don't know what that back end number is going to look like. So we can't forecast it, you know. And we also, on our deals, we are forecasting probably a lot more conservative exit cap rates than a lot of our, you know, I guess competition would, per se, right? Which is only gonna, you know, manipulate numbers on the back end. So you play these model sensitivities and the numbers can get fully turned off and changed and whatnot. So just, you know, look into that, be aware of what you're buying into, and be aware of how people can kind of, I guess, create assumptions and numbers that may be a little bit you know, more conservative in nature or a lot more aggressive in nature based on a couple of sensitivities.
Yeah, so to finish the point on baking in a cushion into your model, it's going to reduce your projected IRR and your projected cash on cash. Therefore, the deal is going to look less attractive to your investors. So you might have a harder time raising capital, and it might all be for nothing, because in the end, you might lock right where you thought you were to lock, so the numbers are better, right? Yeah. However, the other thing about baking in a cushion into your interest rate is what it does to your offer price to the seller. So if we rewind back before you have the deal under control, in your bidding process, if you're maintaining a cushion, that's going to make your top bid price lower, because you're not going to be able to stretch on your price offer to the seller quite as far if you're baking in such a big cushion, which means it's going to be harder to win the deal and harder if all buyers are baking in this cushion, which today you're seeing that. All buyers have to some extent bake in some cushion because there's just higher volatility.
Yeah.
If you're going razor thin at your interest rate, the moves are too big, and what's going to happen is you're going to get into the deal and you're going to be forced to have to retrade the seller, and the deal's going to fall out of contract, which right now we're seeing a lot of deals go under contract and fall out due to many things, including debt volatility, being unable to raise the equity, or finding that the deal is not in as good of condition. And this, I know I'm going to do a quick digression here, but when the market's going up and up and up and there's unlimited capital, there's no physical distress because everyone has the money to renovate their deals. Everyone has the money to invest into the properties because they know that rents are going up, and so it makes sense to do so. Well, now that we've been in a down market and rents are going down and capital is kind of being sucked out of the room, there's less leverage from lenders and equity is more scarce, right? Equity is sitting on the sidelines. What you're seeing now is those capital markets dynamics are trickling in to the space market, into the physical market, and properties themselves are now becoming dilapidated and their condition is getting worse because people aren't spending on CapEx and they're not managing their properties to the full extent. Because if you know your deal is worth less than the loan amount, why are you going to even bother to be a great manager and to invest CapEx into the deal? So we're seeing deals go under contract and people do their due diligence and they go, whoa, this deal's in way worse shape than I thought. And they're falling out. So that's a little digression. And that's why we're actually budgeting more on CapEx for deals that we're looking to buy now, because we know there's going to be more problems today than before.
And circling back to the front end, if you like the number of the higher debt note and you can sell that deal there, boy, oh boy, won't everyone love when you've got way lower and the deal only gets better. And over the course of that deal process, the cash on cash should only be better as well. So that brought me back to that point right there, which is interesting. Another reason volatility is challenging is because guess what happens if you think debt's going to be here and then debt runs in the wrong direction? This is when one of two things happens. Three things happens. You keep it as is, of course. You don't change it. You ask for a retrade. Because the deal's materially different now, because interest rates, when they go up, deal value and valuations get compressed. And then finally, not only does that happen, you walk away, you stay in, or you retrade, right? So those are the three scenarios. So that's why, you know, typically speaking, when there's volatility, usually going in the up direction, not the down direction, creates a market where not a lot of trades occurs. And that's frankly what we've been seeing, of course, over the last 24 months, really, to be realistic, as, you know, rates kind of started shooting up. So interesting there, not fun. Interesting topic, though, that did come up, of course, during RaiseFest, switching gears, is co-GPs and the interesting natures of what co-GP relationships do or don't look like, but, you know, the weight-pulling process of co-GPing. So we met with someone who, unfortunately, is getting capital called at one of their deals, and he had about 80% of investors meet the capital call, and he was really working hard, credit to him for doing so, and it was kind of firing the wagons to make that happen. But it sounded like his other partners on the deal were kind of checked out and absentee on that. So just kind of think about, you know, the co-GP process, kind of the clunky nature to it, large in part why the fund model is probably becoming more normalized, if you will, and brought into, and the need for it. But I thought it was very interesting on that topic, if you want to kind of let your thoughts out here on this topic.
Well, I don't think it really is a difference between co-GP and fund manager.
Not from a capital call perspective, but responsibility perspective.
Well, but if you are a fund manager, so that means your fund is an LP in the deal, and that deal issues a capital call, then as the LP, the fund that's an LP in that deal has a responsibility, of course, depending on the terms of the capital call based on the limited partnership agreement or the operating agreement of the offer of the deal. You have that responsibility to do that, whether you're a co-GP partner and you have to go wrangle your investors, or you're a fund manager and you have to come up with the capital call at the fund level. However, I think the point, I mean, my take on that situation is those other co-GP partners in that deal that failed to meet the call or had a far lower contribution percentage to that capital call, I don't know if it's necessarily due to laziness, as it might more so have to do with economics.
I think phrasing it like they kind of just gave up and threw in the towel was kind of my understanding of that. And we don't know the situation, but there's multiple wrinkles and layers associated with the unfun topic of a capital call,
yeah,
right?
It could be the case, right? But I'm just broadening the conversation. I'm just generalizing, because what I want to kind of consensus in the market, if we're going to paint with a broad brush, 50% of deals on bridge loans today, the equity is worthless. Right, the deal is not worth the bridge loan amount. That's just a broad brushstroke. That's kind of consensus in the market. I don't mean to be disparaging. And then another one that's similar to that is, I would say that, I haven't really thought about this, I haven't thought this through, but 50% of capital calls, frankly, if not more, are not worth meeting.
Well, and what would be worth meeting, in my opinion, and correct me if I'm wrong here, what would be worth meeting here, and this is if you're, another PSA for full of them today, that rhymed, would be this thought here. If you are making a capital call, the only reason why you should theoretically do it is if you're getting yourself situated to a long-term position where you're fixed and the deal can survive another 3 to 4 to 5 years, where the market will, of course, rebound. If you're just meeting a couple of missed payments, or you're feeding an alligator property with no long-term solution, then this is pointless, theoretically, because as you always say, I'm going to let you say your line here, what's worse than losing your money once?
Right. Why lose 100% of your equity on a deal when you could lose 120%?
Right. Exactly. So things to think about if you are in that situation, really audit where that capital is going to, and be very, I'm not telling you to make a capital call or not. You have your relationship with your sponsors, and we'd be very grateful if we were in a less than desirable situation where we didn't need to make a capital call and we needed to have an infusion there one way or another, that our investors would meet it. And I spoke with one of our investors, a very lovely lady, you know who you are, who said, hey, listen, I would love to invest in your deal, but I have loyalty to the sponsor who's been so good for me some time. I need to make this because I like them so much.
Right. So just to clarify what you're saying there, we have an investor who...
Not in our deal.
Right. We have an investor who couldn't invest into one of our properties because they... elected to not, because they were receiving capital calls from other deals in their portfolio from a sponsor that they were loyal to and they felt obligated to. So, and that's actually an interesting situation, because I'm an LP in a deal, for example, where it's a partner, it's a friend who's the sponsor, and I'm just the LP, right? I don't make decisions. I'm not a major partner per se, but I was capital called in the deal, like many deals are being capital called today. And I met the call not for financial reasons. I didn't crunch the numbers and think, okay, well, it's better to not be diluted here. I'm going to ante up and make the call because it's going to be a good financial decision. I made the call as a friend to the sponsor, basically. And I think that is exactly what you're saying here from this particular individual as well.
So it's not logical, it's emotional. It's kind of what we're getting at as well. Sometimes these are not logical choices, because let's say if you had $50,000 to put into the deal, I can assure you your $50,000 is going to look a lot better in a deal that we're acquiring right now or over the next 24 months than it would in a deal that was bought at the rate at the high with a terrible debt and equity structure.
It's very, very unlikely that meeting a capital call into a deal that was purchased in 2021 is going to be money better spent than putting that equity into a fresh deal in 2024.
And quite frankly, if you had $100,000 you invested in a deal there and put $50,000 in a deal, new deal right now, over the 5-year span, which if you did meet a capital call and the deal was held, it will likely be held for another 3 to 4 to 5 years. There's a very good likelihood that you could invest $50,000 in a deal of ours right now, which is our minimum, of course, if you were wondering. If you were to invest that money right now, you could get the $100,000 back and kind of reset your, you know, your dispositions there for your equity perspective quicker than if you put it in one of those deals that is, you know, essentially from a paper perspective and a valuation perspective, worthless.
Right. Going back to your point, which is the kind of the crux of a capital call, is are you the capital call funds for a rate cap replacement? Is it for CapEx or is it for gap equity because you're doing a cash in refi? I think the best use of funds is for a cash in refi because, like you said, you're basically taking risk of permanent loss of capital off the table. You're going from, in many circumstances, a high leverage floating rate bridge loan, which is suffocating you from a cash flow perspective because you're talking about like an 8 to 9% rate. No property can handle an 8 to 9% rate indefinitely. And then you're also suffocated by leverage, right? The bridge loan is up here, the property's value is up here. So you're suffocated from a value and a cash flow standpoint. And so if you can actually do a refi into long-term fixed rate debt at a lower leverage point, you're reshuffling the ratio of debt to equity in the deal. So a cash in refi is the best use of capital call funds, but the hard part about it is that means it's usually a big capital call because that gap between the bridge loan leverage point and the lower leverage of a long-term fixed rate loan, there's a gap there. And that gap could be substantial. So you could be making a 30%, 40% capital call of your original investment versus a 15 to 20%, depending on what those uses are. So those are the three uses. Like I said, it could be for a cash in refi. You could be calling more funds for CapEx because the sponsor wants to rush and do more capital expenditures to try to increase income and raise the value of the property. But I'm not a fan of that at all because it's very difficult to out NOI your cap rate, which is something I like to say a lot, which means that it's very difficult to raise the income of the property, to increase the value of the property, while the cap rate is going up, right? Moves in cap rate can erase increases in NOI to increase your value. And if you are interested in making more sense of what I'm saying, you can just build a quick little Excel model and play with the equation, which is just simply value is a function of your income divided by your cap rate. And then, of course, that's all changeable, right? You can also say, well, your cap rate is your income divided by value, right? It's the most important ratio in commercial real estate. And you can play around with that and see that, okay, well, if you increase NOI a little bit, but then blow out the cap rate, you're underwater.
Very good. Speaking of, you know, nuances and IRRs and placement and equity structuring, another topic we're going to talk about is deep in the money caps is trading IRR for yield. So can you explain kind of what that looks like? Obviously, when you have a floating rate debt, what happens is you're going to want to buy a rate cap. And if you didn't, you probably lost all of your money if you invested in a deal in 2021 or 2022, unless it was a unicorn of unicorns. But in all likelihood, you probably, if you didn't buy a rate cap, do that. But buying a rate cap is not cheap. So can you explain the premise of this and really unpack this in the most Rob Beardsley fashion as possible?
Yeah. What we're hearing in today's environment is those that are opting for floating rates, which I don't want to demonize floaters whatsoever. I know that it's easy to look back at the last couple of years and demonize floating rate loans because they burned everybody.
There's arguably only a couple of times in history where floating rate debt was really unaccretive. And this was probably the worst time in history that it ever occurred, frankly. And I think that was largely part to the fact that rates should have never have gotten as low as it did. That's a whole other can of worms.
And then also the Fed misguided the market because the Fed essentially promised, in different words, promised to keep rates low for another 2 to 3 years. And then maybe 4 months after that statement, they began on a journey of raising rates at the fastest pace in modern history.
Correct. So, and I just want to say this as well, if you're an operator, if you're a capital raiser, if you're an investor who has gotten burnt from one of these deals, just realize this is a very unique place in history of commercial real estate. You are not a bad investor, probably. This is just, I mean, well, I don't know the parameters of the deal. Very likely you didn't really make the dumbest decision of your life or your worst investment decision. It's just the market got really wonky really quick due to many reasons. But explain kind of maybe the pricing associated with buying deep in the money caps and how that might affect the IRR, the right. cash flows, and everything else associated there.
Yeah. So with that disclaimer about floating rate loans, we're not saying that they're evil.
And we might do one for the right deal, on an assumption deal maybe, wink, wink, nod, nod, if something comes our way.
You're giving away our juice.
Exactly. If there's a right profile and structuring, it makes sense. If we were buying a
deal. Who knows? We might be cooking up something
interesting. Exactly. There might be something oven baking, all right? That's neither here nor there. What is here and there and right now is breaking down this topic.
Yeah, finally getting to this topic.
Exactly. We're belaboring the point. Yeah.
Right. We're filibustering.
Yes.
All right. For those that are doing floaters today, it is popular to buy deep in the money interest rate caps. A deep in the money interest rate cap is when you're buying well below today's interest rate. Well, let me be more precise, today's index rate. So most floating rate loans are based on SOFR. And SOFR is directly controlled by the Fed. SOFR today is 5.3%. If you were to buy an at the money strike interest rate cap, that means you'd be buying a rate cap at 5.3%. If rates go any above 5.3%, your interest rate cap, which is essentially insurance, steps in and covers the added interest cost. And so you're fully protected over 5.3%. So you bought an at the money strike. Now, if you buy an out of the money strike for an interest rate cap, let's say a 6% strike, and today's index is 5.3%, you maintain exposure to rising rates up to 6%. So you have 70 basis points of exposure to rising floating rates, but then above 6%, you are again capped. So that would be an out of the money strike. So we have in the money, we have out of the money, or sorry, we have at the money, out of the money, and now we have in the money. So an in the money strike, let's say, is 5%. So you're buying a 5% strike, but rates are 5.3%. And now also, just mind you, we're talking about the index rate. You still have your lender spread of 2%, which is crazy to say because we're talking about floating rates today of 7.3%. That is a very high going in pay rate, which is why, even though it is market consensus that floating rates are going to fall and the Fed will lower rates this year.
But for right now,
it's hard to stomach the going in pay rate of 7.3.
And also it's speculative too if that rates will come down. We don't know. And honestly, I really take whatever the Fed says as a grain of salt. I do believe, as we mentioned or spoke with that one guy, like, every election year rates do get cut. I likely think that maneuvering will in fact transpire. But until it has happened, it hasn't. And until it has happened, you're looking at that really high rate in the face right now, indefinitely, right, until otherwise, which is challenging.
For sure. And let me also make another point about the pain associated with that day one pay rate. If you have a 7.3% all-in rate on a floater today, and you're doing agency financing, which this is what we're talking about, we're focusing on agency, Fannie and Freddie, the agencies are going to size your loan based on that day one pay rate. Your DSCR calculation is going to be based on 7.3%. That means you're not going to be able to get as much leverage. A floating rate loan might get you, just to paint numbers, 65% LTV because you're constrained to a 1.25x minimum DSCR based on your 7.3% rate. Whereas if you were to do the fixed rate equivalent loan, that rate might be today 6.1%, and your DSCR, again, is going to be sized to a minimum 1.25x, but it's going to be at a lower rate of 6.1 versus 7.3. So you're going to qualify for more leverage. So you're going to get a 70% LTV loan instead of 65, which is, of course, going to be more accretive if leverage is what you're looking for. And in my opinion, I don't think the difference there is going to be meaningful from a risk standpoint, because while the LTV is greater, you're sizing to the same debt service coverage ratio. And I think a 1.25 is a healthy
cushion
there. So that's the other dynamic of choosing fixed versus floating. It's not just you're taking a gamble on fixed versus floating as far as the interest rate over the hold period. You're also affecting how the deal is underwritten from an LTV standpoint today and potentially from an interest-only perspective, because of course the agencies utilize their exit test to determine how much interest-only they're willing to give for the loan. There's one other thing I wanted to mention about that, but it's escaping me. So let's get back to the in-the-money strike for the cap. So if you buy a 5% strike and the index is 5.3, the day you close, your interest rate cap is going to be paying out value, because there's a 30 basis point difference between where the index is today and where you bought the strike at. So day one, you're not paying a 7.3% rate, you're paying a 7% rate because your cap is in the money. Now, of course, that's not free. Like you said, interest rate caps, especially in the money caps, are expensive, because obviously if the bank that your counterparty in this hedge, in this trade, is seeing that you're buying an in-the-money strike, well then day one, they know they're gonna be paying out that value. So you're basically prepaying interest by buying.
You're front loading to the bank to basically let you borrow the money. So you're giving them a massive fee front, right, as a hedge.
Instead of paying a 7.3% rate, I can buy an in-the-money strike, and if you're my counterparty, I'm just gonna give you money up front. Basically, I'm buying points up front in exchange for a lower rate in the future.
So you can buy down, if you're doing fixed rate debt, of course, you can do the same thing. You can buy down your interest rate, right? You can buy, exactly, you can pay for it one way or another, right?
So the agencies do allow you to do a rate buy down in certain circumstances. These rate buy downs became super popular recently for various reasons, namely because it allowed you to size to a higher leverage point. Because if you're able to buy the rate down, now you're able to get more leverage, because again, you're sized to that minimum 1.25 DSCR. And this is actually a really interesting dynamic that played out in the market and is still playing out in certain circumstances.
Oh, it hasn't played out all right. And when in 5 years, it might be fully flushed out, frankly.
Well, with how low cap rates got, DSCRs were super tight. And so you couldn't size to a lot of leverage on agency debt. So what people started doing is doing big buy downs. Like you'd pay 3% of the loan amount upfront as a buy down to buy the rate down by, let's say, 54 basis points or something like that. And with a lower rate, you're able to size to a higher leverage point while still maintaining that same 1.25 DSCR. And what was interesting is you might pay down or pay for a 3% buy down, but that will get you, let's say, 6% of increased leverage. So in the end, you net 3 points of leverage, if that makes sense, right? You paid 3%, you get 6, so you net 3. So that was a dynamic a lot with fixed rate loans, but now the agencies are kind of, it's a bit nebulous as far as what you can do. But the interesting thing about floaters, sticking on this in the money strike concept, is to your point, it's really the same dynamic as just buying down your rate. You're trading, this is the whole crux premise, that we wanted, yeah, the premise that we wanted to cover with this notion is, you're basically just prepaying interest. And what you're doing is you're trading IRR in exchange for cash on cash. Because when you prepay interest, and also this hurts you from a time value of money standpoint, right? Because all else being equal, why would you prepay your interest up front if you could just prepay, if you could just pay your interest over time, right? The time value of money would imply to you, or would tell you, to pay the interest over time, right? That's why people have mortgages on their house, because they can't afford to just buy the house outright, right?
Which are very front loaded to interest on the front end, might I add.
Yes, that
is true.
You're
basically paying all interest on the front, you know, part of it, and then at the end it starts really paying off the principal.
Right. So that's the dynamic that we're seeing in the market, and I'm not saying that this is a bad strategy, but
just the difference is, and the market needs options, and our options with the marketplace is fixed rate debt, because we're controlling that. So let me just paint a picture here for those who are really, that are maybe just newer to the commercial real estate space. We have listeners at a full spectrum. We've got private equity, massive institutions listening to this, which we're really proud of. And we also have people that have never done a real estate deal or investment together that are looking and are, you know, in their teens, frankly. We've got people that are coming up to Rob and saying how I've followed you for this long, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So let's paint a picture where you bought a deal at a 3% cap rate, which, or 3 to 4% cap rate, which frankly was not that uncommon in some of the very peak markets. Let's call Phoenix, maybe some place in Florida, so on and so forth. Maybe Dallas, maybe Austin, this, that. So you have that there. Next thing you know, you have floating rate debt. If you didn't do a rate cap, well, let me paint the picture. You've got rents that are right now, on the grand scheme of things, going slightly down or staying stagnant. Occupancy is becoming worse.
I'm happy to let you play out this scenario, and sorry to interrupt, But to make things simple, let's say people bought at a 3 cap, and let's say, you know, rents maybe went up, but maybe occupancy is going down, things are flat. Let's just say the 3 cap is still a 3 cap.
Okay. But you have...
But your rate is now 9%.
Yeah, you've locked in at a point where maybe your debt was par at your cap rate, right? Because rates were so low, right?
If you locked in a long-term fixed rate.
Exactly. Well, no, but if you are a floating rate, maybe locked in that number there. Now that number is floating up. Your cap rate's here, okay? And now, let's say if you have a couple years, you need to sell it. You need, and the maturity's coming up in a little bit. Okay, well, now you've got a cap rate. You bought at a 3. The market might not be like a 5%. And then your debt's here. You're gonna sit, and then now your insurance has gone up. Your rents maybe have softened. Maybe you don't have money to do the improvements to get to the income level to get your exit. You can do the math as to how negative of a storm this has created for you and your property and the headache that you're dealing with, right? This is called evaporation of equity, right? This is a massive problem that a lot of the market is experiencing right now, which is very unfortunate. But that is sometimes how the cookie crumbles. And for cycles to restart, people need to feel pain and lose money, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah, just to add on some thoughts to this deep in the money cap thing. A rate cap, the cost of a rate cap is comprised of two factors: volatility and prepaid interest, right? If you are to buy an out of the money rate cap, let's go back to our scenario where you're buying a 6% strike and today SOFR is 5.3, the price of your cap is fully based on volatility, because rates aren't projected to go to 6%. So there isn't any sort of value projected payout that your trader, if you're trading with the bank on this cap, in their forward curve, there's no projected payout that they're underwriting because rates aren't projected to go to 6. Now, of course, they have to account for volatility and transaction costs to engage in this hedge with you. So there's going to be some cost to this cap, but a 6% strike interest rate cap is going to be very cheap, because you're not, all you're paying for is the slight chance that rates go up to 6. So you're just paying for volatility. Now, if you buy a deep in the money cap, like let's say really deep, which some people are doing, let's say you're buying a cap that is a 2% strike. And that means today SOFR is 5.3 and you're buying a strike of 2. So you're deep in the money by 3.3%. And if you buy a year-long cap, that means you basically prepaid for 3.3% worth of interest cost. Your hedge provider, the rate cap provider, is obviously going to price in that 3.3%, and they're going to price for volatility. So it's comprised of those two things. Also, let me clarify. We're kind of focusing this discussion about new acquisitions. So when we're talking about people buying deep in the money caps, this is an elected purchase, because when you're making new acquisitions, generally the lender doesn't force you to buy an in the money cap. They usually force you to buy either an at the money or a slightly out of the money cap. That's usually the minimum requirement. But these days, it's very popular for a buyer to go above and beyond the minimum lender required minimum strike and they're buying deep in the money, like for example 2%. So they're manufacturing what could be a 4 or 5% rate, call it more like 5.5, which is how they're manufacturing better cash flows to their investors. And I really want to hammer that point home, because the investor might look at the cash flow and go, oh, the cash flow is strong on this deal, but they need to look at the fact that the naked rate is actually 8.5, 9%. So if you look at the true cash flow of the deal, or if you kind of unload or unpack that rate cap and just use a naked rate over the NOI of the deal, the cash flow is not good. I'm not saying the deal's bad, but the cash flow is not good. You're relying on the buy-sell spread to make that deal successful. And you're burdening your basis with that rate cap. So really think about this. We all know basis is the most important thing in real estate, which means the price that you pay. But your basis is not just your price. It's also your closing costs. It's also the fees. And it's so sponsor fees, right? And it's also the CapEx budget and the interest rate cap. So if you're loading the deal up and burdening it with a very expensive interest rate cap, that's going to make it harder to make a profit when you go sell. Because now you've built up your basis. You're in the deal for your all-in cost of, let's say, $40 million. And now to really turn a good profit and make a big return, you're going to need to sell for $60 million. Whereas if you were let's say, reduce the scope of your renovations, the sponsor charged lower fees, and you didn't buy an interest rate cap that was so expensive, now maybe your basis is $36 million, $35 million, and you could turn a profit at $55 million exit price. So that's the other nuance. And when we're talking about buying in the money caps on new acquisitions. Now, the crazy thing is, on legacy deals, deals that people bought in 2020, 2021, and early 22 before rates rose, people were buying the minimum strike interest rate cap that the lender was making them purchase. And again, like I said, they usually make you buy at the money or slightly out of the money. Well, guess what? SOFR was zero back then. So an out of the money cap was a 1% strike, a 1.5%, 2% strike. Well, guess what's in the loan docs? The mandate to purchase a replacement rate cap at the same strike. So if you bought a 1.5% strike a couple years ago and your interest rate cap has expired and you have to buy a new one, you're now obligated to buy at that 1.5% strike, which means you're going to have to prepay now 4% worth of interest for 12 months, which is the minimum term for a replacement cap.
A lot of money. So if you do the math on that, can you do the math and nap on my calculator, because your phone is obviously recording, as to what that theoretically
would
look like?
If you have a $50 million loan, $50 million loan, I mean, this is easy math, but a $50 million loan, all you have to do is do 4% of $50 million, that's $2 million bucks. You have to prepay a year's worth of interest, which is $2 million. So at that moment in time, your deal has to cough up $2 million.
How can people get it? From the sponsors, from the investors, or...
Or they can play chicken with the lender and go into default.
Yeah.
So the deal might be able to come up with that $2 million over the course of 12 months through rents. But how many of these deals have $2 million laying around to buy that replacement?
In this environment, likely not, because especially with how leverage got at that point.
Right.
You know, leverage was so crazy then with the interest rates being so low that, you know, basically any deal sized up. That's not the case, obviously, right now.
So not only is it a cash flow issue, it's also a cash flow timing issue. Because, right, if I said, hey, I'm selling my house, do you want to buy it? Well, you have to pay all the money up front. Or if you say, well, I can't afford that. But if I said, hey, I'm going to sell or carry my house and you can just pay me over a 30-year mortgage, you say, oh, well, I can afford this house now, right? So some of these deals can afford technically the interest, but if they're asked to prepay it all up front,
well, are some deals not worth that as well, which goes back to the capital call conversation.
That's a whole can of worms.
You can see how this all, you know, selectively, of course, you know, no surprise, we wanted to intertwine it together like that. So from a premise perspective for the show, so very interesting. Do you have any other thoughts on that kind of topic there? Cool. Another thought we have thinking about is pitching the lowest returns possible while maintaining being fully funded. So we want to really attract investors who are comfortable with seeing, you know, a number probably closer to 13 or 14 than 20. We want to train our investors to benchmark at a lower number so we can underpromise and overdeliver the Lone Star way, right? So we are really trying to find and attract folks who want to be in deals that are more conservative in nature, where we're not taking liberties with regards to our projections. So this is something that we constantly want to working on what sensitivities and levers we want to pull or not to make our deals make sense. Because ultimately, as you always say, the person who wins the deal is the one who pays the most. So it's a balancing act between, you know, threading the needle of getting the lowest purchase price possible, but also then on the second fold of once we have the deal under LOI, working through the PSA, of getting the deal, you know, basically pre-subscribed and fully funded from a commitment perspective. When you're seeing our deal versus someone else's deals, when you're making the choice to raise for your next opportunity, if you're an institutional fund, you know, looking to deploy equity, or if you are one of our, you know, kind of capital raising partners going for a deal, if you see a deal that's a 20 IRR or a deal that is a, you know, 14 IRR, well, logically, a lot of people might want to jump to the 20, but the makeup of the deal are obviously massively different.
There's a lot to unpack here as well, unfortunately, so bear with me. But what you just were referring to is the capital raiser or the fund manager perspective here as well as the LP perspective. Obviously, from an LP perspective, if we're pitching LPs a higher return, that's going to make them more excited and it's going to be easier to raise the money. Similarly, the higher the return we're projecting
on the front end.
Right. You're making life easier up front, but making life harder later. And then similarly, for a fund manager, if we're pitching a higher return to the fund manager, here's what happens. It's easier for the fund manager to justify their fees and their promote, right? It's easier to justify the double waterfall because there's more margin in the deal.
Can you explain what you mean by double waterfall? Because you kind of skipped a gear there. So just for more context, can you kind of just go into what that kind of entails?
Yeah, the way a fund-to-fund is structured is the parent level or our deal has obviously a promote structure. So it might be an 8 or 9% pref, and then there's a split above that preferred return. And that waterfall, the cash flow distributions flow through that waterfall, and then those residual distributions are paid out to the fund manager or to that fund as a whole. And then at that fund level, there's another set of fees and promote that is charged by that fund manager to facilitate that fund and to raise the capital and pull the capital into that fund. So the LPs of that fund are subject to a double promote. They have to pay the fees and promote at the deal level, and then they have to pay it at the fund level, and then they get their residual return. Now, of course, that all makes sense because we work on a discounted basis at the parent level, so that way, in the end, the double waterfall isn't punitive to the fund-to-fund LP returns. So with a higher return projection, the fund manager is projected to make more money because their promote on paper is projected to be worth more, and they can pay out to their investors an attractive return. It's easier for them to raise money because the numbers look more attractive. They're happier because their projected compensation is higher. So everybody wins on the front end with higher projected returns. But of course, we know that higher projected returns can bite you somewhere later, right? Which gets into overpromising and underdelivering, which is obviously anathema. It's counter to what we do at Lone Star, which we strive to underpromise and overdeliver. The reason why we're talking about this is I was asked the question recently, hey, what is an attractive return? What return should a multifamily sponsor be pitching to his or her investors to make sense for a deal? Is it, you know, 14% return? Is it 20% return? What makes sense? And I gave kind of a coy, but the best answer possible, which was you should pitch to your investors the lowest possible return you can get away with pitching to your investors while still fully funding and oversubscribing your deal.
And the reason by that is eventually at some point we all have a little thing that's known as a track record. If you have your track record associated with the deal, you're going to benchmark actual versus projection. If you are the boy who cried wolf and are saying this deal's going to be a 25 IRR and you hit 11s all day long, you are terrible. If you conversely are saying this is going to be a 10 IRR and you hit 11, well then you're incredible. Right? So it cuts both ways. So we want to have a world in which our fund managers, our joint venture equity group people, our LPs, and everyone that's associated with Lone Star Capital is seeing lower numbers, and then we overhit those numbers. Our life will be a lot better. So as you said, do you want to, you know, work harder today for a better tomorrow? The answer, of course, is yes, because we're going to be in business forever.
Delayed gratification, the marshmallow test.
Exactly. Any other thoughts on this?
No, I think we need to wrap. Yeah, sorry, Jeremy, this podcast is running long.
Yeah, Jeremy, we're trying to make it concise and good for you.
We're not going to ramble too long.
Exactly. Well, once more, if you're a fund manager, if you're a capital raiser, if you're an LP investor, if you've got a 1031 exchange coming up, please reach out to myself. I would love to help you out and figure out a way for us to help you out at Lone Star Capital and for us to solve for your needs. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We look forward to doing a lot more content here in Sedona. Take care, y'all.